Hey everyone, this is Derek Bros with the Conscious Resistance Network, and today I have a returning guest, somebody who I know many of you are excited to hear from, Whitney Webb, a journalist who needs no introduction and who has been doing just fantastic work both at The Last American Vagabond and Unlimited Hangout. We're going to be getting into three of Whitney's articles and a couple of mine that all sort of intersect in the conversations around Cyberpolygon, domestic extremism, this new Welcome Leap program that you guys are going to want to hear about, and so much more. Thanks for joining me, Whitney.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me back on. My pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and get started. Last week was Cyberpolygon. We're going to talk a lot about that exercise.
Woohoo! Celebrate, yeah.
Right? Cyberpolygon. At least I guess we could celebrate that nothing has happened so far for anybody who's expecting something to happen on the day of. But that has come and gone now. We're going to talk a lot about not the event itself, but some of the players around it. But I just wanted to ask before we get into some of those details, Cyberpolygon is simulating, preparing for supply chain disruption, you know, remaking the financial system. They're telling us there's this all this cyber threats, et cetera, et cetera. Do you personally take any of those simulations, threats, fears serious and serious enough that is there anything you're doing personally to prepare? Like, do you stock food? Do you have, you know, is there anything like that that you do personally? Or what are your thoughts on just their conversations around this? Is this something people should take seriously?
Yeah, so I think a lot of what Cyberpolygon is about is sort of laying out the end game and a lot of the solutions that they want to implement in the event that this cyber pandemic that's been predicted by the World Economic Forum, its many partners, and other related organizations as basically inevitable. If that does come to pass, Cyberpolygon is about laying out the so-called solutions, the solutions they want to offer to a problem you could argue they created or may help create. It remains to be seen. but I think it's ultimately about that. So you touched on some of those agendas there. I would say ones that I would add to that, that they discuss at Cyberpolygon, are efforts to regulate the internet and create like basically a global framework for confronting cybercrime, justifying that through this proliferation of ransomware attacks, which I would argue is a not so veiled attempt to go after cryptocurrency. At the same time, we're seeing a lot of institutions, including those directly partnered with the WEF, trying to launch these central bank digital currencies. So in terms of preparedness, you know, I think people should be prepared that this may happen because they're essentially telling us it will happen and that it's inevitable. And a lot of these agendas have been attempted in the past. So in the case of one of the agendas linked to Cyberpolygon that I wrote about recently, was actually promoted and almost was piloted, proposed and piloted under the Obama administration, but couldn't go any farther because of resistance from the ACLU and the EFF and groups like that. It was about having a driver's license for the internet, essentially a government issued ID that was linked to government access so that the government knows what sites you're visiting, what content you're consuming online, all under the guise of combating cybercrime. But of course, back during that period in like 2011, 2014 and so on, the different times they tried to do this under Obama, they didn't really have the traction then because people were like, well, why do we need that? You know, the justification wasn't really there. But if you have a proliferation of cybercrime and major cyber attacks that disrupt people's life, you know, you can manufacture consent for those policies because the second you have a major disruption to people's lives that's blamed on a cyber attack, you know, it'll be they could easily say, well, we have to stop the cyber criminals. And this is the way to end anonymity online so the government can see who's engaging in cybercrime and who is not. But of course, if you actually read between the lines of what these groups at the WEF and their different partnerships related to this, what they want to do, you know, they define cyber criminal very broadly, not unlike the Biden administration has defined domestic terrorism very broadly. And it's no coincidence, of course, that you have, you know, the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI and the Secret Service all partnering with the WEF on that particular agenda. So with some of these other things going on as well, like this effort to reset the financial system, you have the WEF working with directly with central banks all around the world, including the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve, and also groups like FSISAC, the Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which is essentially the chief information security officers of all of the biggest Wall Street banks getting together to basically say a cyber attack on the financial system is inevitable, and things like this. And what better way to blame the inevitable collapse of the economic system due to corruption and the malfeasance of central banks and private banks? You can blame it on faceless hackers, which you can attribute to a nation state or a terrorist group or whatever, and absolve the guilty parties entirely if it's a cyber attack. And I think these groups definitely want to do that. And if you look at something like what the WEF's Center for Cybersecurity has been putting out, they openly say that these actors are coming together, that are the different partners here, including these Wall Street banks, are coming together to develop what they openly say is a shared narrative. Notice it's not a shared commitment to the facts or truth, right? It's a shared narrative about achieving their long-term strategic interests. And you know, that is basically about developing a common story to be fed to the public that advances their long-term strategic objectives, whether or not what they're saying is actually true or not, or based in fact, or best for the people, or whatever. It's just, you know, what's best for them and for advancing public-private partnerships, of course, which is favored by the WEF. And in practice, you know, this public-private partnership here, as it relates to Cyber Polygon, is basically a merging of the private public sector and also law enforcement agencies and intelligence agencies all together. And if you read my work on these topics, it's pretty clear that's where they're hoping to take this, whether it's the WEF Carnegie Endowment for International Peace Report with Wall Street and central bankers, or the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime that includes the US government, the UK government, Israel's government, several banks, and numerous private sector companies, including Microsoft. So big tech is there, of course, as well. So, you know, these aren't small time players. These are people that have obvious long-term strategic interests in things like, you know, in the case of Microsoft, you know, they have things like ID 2020 and other things that they want to advance too. That ties into this whole agenda for having identity tied to your internet access and all of this stuff. And so there, you know, and there's several agendas at play here, like I was just saying. So they're coming together to develop a narrative to sell that to the public, and specifically a narrative to use after a particular financial event takes place. And some of these policy documents talk openly about that, about working with social media companies to develop a narrative as soon as an event happens or even before an event happens, so that they can be consistent and cohesive in terms of the public messaging. But all of that, they pretty much openly say, doesn't have to be based in fact or anything true. It just has to be, you know, enough to get the public to go along with policies that are in the long-term strategic interest of these public and private sector partners.
So that's a yes, that people should be prepared.
Yeah. So in terms of different ways to prepare, at Unlimited Hangout, we're working sort of on a how-to guide, giving people different options about ways to sort of shore up your privacy online and decouple from big tech, but still use services that, you know, you may find essential to your work or personal life or social life or whatever that may be helpful. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it comes down to, you know, what would you do if the internet, you know, is completely turned off one day, or you're not going to be able to depend on supermarkets or something like that happened recently with the most recent supply chain hack on this company, Kaisa, I think it's called, which took out the systems at a bunch of UK supermarkets, the chain there known as Co-op. So, you know, obviously, you know, this could have implications for the food supply, essential goods and whatnot. So, you know, obviously it's a good idea to be prepared in that sense. And of course, you know, in terms of food preparedness, there's also, I would say, sort of an effort, I think, in engineering famines in some countries that normally don't experience them. So in one case in the UK, they're talking about rolling food shortages. And they're some of them are trying to blame it on climate change, but it's very clearly a truck driver a shortage of truck driver situation. And that's a government policy decision, essentially, at the end of the day. It doesn't have anything to do with climate change, but that's going to have complications. And the Guardian just reported today that the food sector, grocery stores, what have you, are very vulnerable to cyber attack in the UK. It'll be interesting to see if the seeding of that narrative grows or not, but it's always best to be prepared. So I think, you know, having supplies of food, even if it's for a couple weeks or a few months, depending on what you can afford, is obviously a good idea. Being able to meet your essential needs for a set period of time is obviously going to make you more resilient to whatever is coming down the line. There definitely, you know, a lot of stuff could potentially happen. Will it all definitely happen or happen on the same timeline? I mean, we don't really know, but it's definitely better to be prepared than not prepared. In terms of data and stuff, you know, if you have family photos and stuff that you have online and stuff that you want to save, I would personally, you know, back up all of that on an encrypted hard drive and maybe put it in a Faraday bag or something if you want to be extra secure and not lose access to that stuff in the event of stuff getting really crazy in the virtual digital world. You know, those types of keepsakes are important, you know, things you want to back up, whether it's ebooks or stuff from your work or whatever that you want to maintain access to in the event of some sort of catastrophic event in the virtual digital world. You know, that's probably the best way to do that. But also, you know, being able to meet your needs without the virtual world is probably the best thing that anyone could do to prepare.
Yeah, those are some good tips. I appreciate you putting that. I wasn't necessarily expecting you to give us any tips. You know, I was just, but that's good because honestly, that's what people are looking for. Now, I've had so many people in the last week, especially because CyberPolygon just passed, like, hey, what do you mean? How do I prepare? Like when we're saying, hey, I'd be prepared in case something happens. Some people, I think, are looking for practical tips like that. So that's exciting to hear that Unlimited Hangouts is going to work on something as far as, you know, tech security and data security. And you mentioned, you mentioned a lot of good things there, but one of the things we're going to go to next is this talk of domestic extremism and how we're seeing, you've written about this recently, the push for the Biden administration talking about domestic extremism and how now that's tying with cyber terrorism and cyber extremism. And, you know, you also mentioned the push for, as we just saw with CyberPolygon, like you said, they had a conversation about regulating the internet. And this is something that our friend and fellow journalist James Corbett has been reporting on for years, that these folks have wanted a digital ID to access the internet. And they haven't been able to do it for a long time because there has been pushback over the years. I think some people forget that even though it seems like everybody's just accepting things right now, in the past, there actually has been pushback. That's why it's taken them so long. You know, post 9/11, people didn't just roll over right away. You know, people, there still were protests, there still were pushback about the spying, a lot of these activities. But my point here is that this information, this kind of propaganda, it really isn't new. It's just that it's expanded now because I was working on an article for TLAB and I found something I wrote back as far as 2012 of them talking about digital 9/11 and cyber 9/11 was about to happen, you know? And so now it's like cyber pandemic and cyber winter and all these different terms. But it does seem like this has been their agenda for a long time to regulate the internet, to take more control, to, you know, just have more control of our digital virtual lives. And it didn't work in the past, but now we're at a point where they do have more support. Talk a little bit about that, about just this push for domestic extremism and how that relates to the cyber, you know, extremism, cyber terrorism.
Right. So I recently wrote about the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime, and the same people that wrote Biden's domestic terror strategy, the U.S. Department of Justice, the FBI, what have you, are all part of that. Okay, so I think that's really important to point out because that policy document I reported on recently for TLAB came out last November. And of course, the Biden terror, domestic terror strategy was publicly released maybe like a month or so ago. So obviously, if you read both documents, it's pretty clear the domestic terror strategy in the U.S. was definitely informed by the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime. And that's because a lot of this stuff in the domestic terror strategy focuses specifically on stuff that happens on social media and happens online. And that's why we've already seen since that was released, you know, Facebook come out with this this pop-up notification of, do you think someone you know is being radicalized? You've looked at the extremist content. Quote unquote extremist content. and all of this stuff. And I'm sure Twitter will fall in line as well. And they're pretty open in the domestic terror strategy. And we've already seen it happen since the January 6th arrest. You know, your social media history, the comments you made, the things you have liked, are likely to be used against you. So I would argue, it's harder for people like you and me, Derek, to do this. But for, you know, people that aren't content creators, you may want to consider deleting your profiles on the big tech social media platforms. And you can still, you know, follow people there maybe, but I would say make a burner account and don't like or comment anything. Just use it for news feeds and what have you. Though keep in mind that they, you know, algorithmically manipulate everything you see on those. But if you are used to using them, you can still do that without feeding the domestic terror machine, as it were. But, you know, some of the things in this strategy includes things like information sharing between the public and private sector and also with foreign governments. We can assume that that would be Israel and the Five Eyes countries. You know, if history is any indication in terms of U.S. government cooperation with signals intelligence, both legally and illegally, those are the countries that the U.S. tends to do that with. And I think that's really important because it shows it's not really a domestic terror strategy, then, is it? Because it's not dealing with domestic terror so much if you're working with all these other governments, several of which also have hinted that they also wish to pursue domestic extremism in various ways, which will, I'm sure, as time goes along, they'll be quite related. And there's a lot of emphasis as well, you know, that you can be that terrorist activity, you know, it just involves posting content online that's deemed linked to terrorist ideology. And of course, if you actually read the document, or you can read my report on it alternatively, the way they define domestic terrorist is very broad. Anyone they deem to be anti-government or anti-authority, not hard to be in those camps these days, that's for sure. And I also want to really make it clear that while they're framing it publicly as something to go after right-wing terrorism or white supremacy, if you actually read how they define terrorists, it's not that at all. There's clearly indications there that they plan to target people on the left and, you know, people that oppose all forms of capitalism, since they painted this with such a broad brush that could easily be socialists. Or, you know, people that identify as communists, it could if they want to go after socialists and socialism, they could easily define a socialist as someone that campaigned for, volunteered for Bernie Sanders' campaign or something like that. They really don't have to stop. And even if Biden doesn't go that far, what if the next person selected for the office of president happens to be a Republican? They'll obviously weaponize this infrastructure against, you know, both sides. If they don't do it right away, they'll do it at some point in the not so distant future. So obviously, this is infrastructure that needs to be needs to be stopped before it starts, because obviously, you know, the war on terror was a total disaster. And don't think a war on domestic terror will be any different. And I would argue that a lot of the infrastructure set up supposedly for the war on terror, including DHS, the target was always domestic dissidents. If you look at the people responsible for the pivot to Homeland Security in the years leading up to 9/11, these were people that worked on the CIA's Phoenix program in Vietnam. And if you're not familiar with that, Doug Ballantyne's book on it is the seminal work on that. But it was essentially an assassination program for suspected dissidents. That you didn't even actually have to be a confirmed dissident, not unlike what would happen a few years later, thanks to the CIA as well, with Operation Condor in Latin America. And that led to tens and thousands of people, innocent people, being killed and disappeared and tortured and what have you in different countries all over the world. And these were our intelligence agencies, U.S. intelligence agencies, that were planning and perfecting that. And the architects of those plans abroad are the ones that planned DHS, and they tried to pass DHS before 9/11. The legislation to create it was introduced in, I think, March or May of 2001, several months before 9/11. And then 9/11 happens, and all the questions about why do we need a Department of Homeland Security disappear. And, you know, with the justification of that event, it's created and implemented. And similarly, I think this domestic terror strategy, in order to really kick off, needs some sort of big domestic terror 9/11 event on a similar level to the Oklahoma City bombing. Will it be a bombing exactly like that? I don't know, it could easily be the same as a cyber 9/11 that they've been hinting at for years. But instead, you know, the hackers can be, you know, the hack or the cyber attack can be attributed to people deemed terrorists and what have you by the Biden administration. But they obviously need some sort of event to manufacture outrage and get people to demand that something be done. And that clearly isn't the case right now. January 6th wasn't enough to do that because, you know, the death toll is nothing like 9/11. The disruption to the life of everyday Americans was nothing like, you know, 9/11. So I think they definitely need another shoe to drop in order to get in order to sell that in a more effective way to the public and really have that come to the forefront. But they're very busy setting up the infrastructure. And if we look at the timeline when they were setting up that infrastructure with 9/11, such an event is likely to happen probably within the next 1 to 2 years. And that's really concerning. So I think we need to be vigilant about that. And also, you know, because a lot of there was this congressional hearing at the end of February last year, and like no one paid attention to it because that's when, you know, COVID was first really, really hitting and all that stuff. And that whole crisis was coming to the forefront of media attention and everything else. But essentially, the FBI announced that their programs had previously entrapped Muslim Americans and essentially created terrorist plots was now pivoting towards white American males as opposed to, you know, Muslim American males. And that's an obvious cause for concern, because if you have been following what the FBI has done since 9/11, most of the terror plots that have been foiled were essentially created or guided or funded or all three by the FBI. And the Governor Whitmer kidnap plot is a textbook example of that. And that just followed a few months after this announced pivot. The FBI announced this pivot. Right. And of course, the FBI is part of this partnership against cybercrime and all of this other stuff, too, working with other governments and private companies to silence dissent. And, you know, if you look at both of those documents, the domestic terror strategy and the partnership against cybercrime, the effort to go after disinformation is very clear. And what's concerning also about the domestic terror strategy is that it's both this obvious effort to censor information the government doesn't like by people deemed anti-government or anti-authority or who complain too loudly about government overreach. to basically censor them, but also to launch a propaganda campaign run and developed by the Department of Homeland Security, which is obviously disconcerting. And there's a company that I wrote about not that long ago, last November for Unlimited Hangout, that's called Primer AI. That's basically a bunch of people that developed algorithms to track insurgents in Iraq for the war on terror, now tracking disinformation online domestically for the Pentagon, and openly talking about how, in addition to AI censorship efforts that they're developing, there needs to be a Wikipedia populated and developed by the U.S. intelligence community to tell people the truth about current and past events. So how do you think that will go, right? But it's important to point out that there's two sides to that effort there, not just the extreme censorship, but also a very sophisticated and obviously well-funded propaganda campaign.
Yeah, as if Wikipedia itself is not already controlled enough. Right? We need one just straight up ran by them, you know.
Yeah, well, even more intense, yeah.
You brought up a few really good points there as far as, you know, the push for domestic extremism, whether it's cyber extremism or in the physical, like you said, it has been happening since 9/11. We saw, and even, well, let me take a step back. You mentioned what was happening before 9/11, right? And I was only 9 years old when the Oklahoma City bombing happened.
Yeah.
10 years old, you know, when that first happened. And so I know others were, that maybe some in our audience weren't even born during 9/11 or right afterwards, right? So it's hard for people to really put it into context. But when you go back and you study the Oklahoma City bombing, which was also a false flag event, that, and I've been meaning to write about this, that people don't realize how we've come full circle, that Biden, you know, he credits himself as writing the Patriot Act. And what he really did was he helped establish the counterterrorism laws, the bill that was passed after the Oklahoma City bombing. So in 1995, they have this domestic terror attack right in Oklahoma City, and they start ramping up that propaganda about militias and extremism and terrorism is coming. And then 6 years later, 9/11 happens, you know, the Pearl Harbor that the Project for a New American Century was calling for. And so this is just the continuation of that same thing. And maybe they focused on, you know, brown people and Muslims for the last 10 to 20 years or so, but we've also now kind of seen it come back around to focusing on white folks or just Americans, right, or just people who say the wrong thing. So we're really dealing with the same machinery here, the same mechanisms that we've been dealing with for, you know, several decades before 9/11, before the Oklahoma City bombing, going back to, like you mentioned, the Phoenix program. And so I think that's important to acknowledge. And then the other point, just kind of side note for those who might not know, you also mentioned Operation Condor. Our good friend Henry Kissinger was, of course, intimately involved with that as well. And yeah, that whole kind of class of people. So it is important, again, that we are dealing with the same systems, the same people, same institutions, mm-hmm, that have been implementing these. And now they're coming around full circle with it. And I want to shift gears now to the push for kind of demonizing and controlling cryptocurrencies and digital currencies, because the other thing that they're saying is that, well, cyber terrorists, they use these anonymous cryptocurrencies online and we don't know how to track them, and which obviously is a lie. In the case of things like Bitcoin, there are more private ones like Monero and others out there, but they're really kind of tying that in this. And we've seen this, of course, with the push for central bank digital currencies, part of the great reset of the economic system. So they're kind of playing it in both ways. They're like, hey, COVID broke the economic system, now we need to reset it. Oh, by the way, cyber terrorists want to use this other, you know, new currency, so we shouldn't, yeah, let them have that. So they're really demonizing and criminalizing decentralized and anonymous cryptos and currencies like that. And then last week at Cyber Polygon, they had a talk called New World, New Currency, How to Make, yes, the Financial System Resilient as Digital Currencies Proliferate.
Yeah, telling title.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's right there, right? So, and then I just want to quote this one section from your article on the FSISAC. It says, quote, the final and most important of these predictions is that the economic drivers towards cybercrime will increase. And basically, they're saying that because of the economic system related to COVID, that cybercrime will probably increase, and that using cryptos will, you know, become an alternative, a attractive alternative for these cyber criminals. So, I mean, the propaganda is thick and strong. Talk a little bit about that, like about this, this push to demonize tools that could, because this is something that you and I have had to go back and forth with other people on about, like the use of blockchain and crypto. Mm-hmm. Neither of us have come from a position to say that blockchain or crypto are like the savior of all things, or that it's perfect or anything like that. But there clearly is value there, and these folks recognize it.
Yeah, so the group you first mentioned, FSISAC, I want to stress that these are Wall Street controlled entities, and they also involve groups like SWIFT, which, if you don't know what SWIFT is, I would encourage you to look it up because it's pretty important. It's basically the main way banks communicate with each other. So we've seen in recent years, you know, talks about deplatforming Russia or China from SWIFT as a way to basically use economic sanctions against them without formally having a new sanction added. Because it's supposed to be like a nonprofit thing. But anyway, they had all these predictions. And yes, so one of the predictions of this Wall Street dominated entity with groups like Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, and all of this behind them, is that the drivers behind cybercrime will increase. Despite, as I point out in my article, despite the fact that the evidence for that claim is not there. There's actually several other predictions that have no basis in fact and no historical precedent to back them up. They're just claims being made by what is essentially a Wall Street controlled entity. And of course, you know, Wall Street is backing certain cryptocurrencies and certain digital currencies, a lot of them stable coins, some of them openly backing central bank controlled digital currencies, but some of them also backing digital currencies that aren't necessarily completely controlled by a central bank or something more along what Russia has gone with. So like China, for example, has the digital yuan that it's piloting. That's a central bank controlled one. But Russia instead has used Sberbank, which, by the way, was the co-sponsor of Cyber Polygon with the World Economic Forum. That is technically a private bank, but its majority owner is the Russian government, right? So Sberbank has Sbercoin, which is Russia's first big digital currency, but it's not decentralized. And it's not really a cryptocurrency. It's more of a stable coin. And they're basically trying to make that, you know, essentially the digital ruble, but not necessarily having it be completely dominated, at least not directly by Russia's central bank. So there's a couple different strategies there, and Wall Street is just trying to make money off of it. Essentially, they see promise in it, but they've been, you know, there's been a lot of reticence by some of the bigger firms to openly back Bitcoin. I think it's because they know that there's this big effort coming to regulate it, and ransomware is, of course, being the main excuse there. But I mean, there's a lot of holes in that narrative as to why regulating Bitcoin is going to reduce cybercrime. So of course, you know, cryptocurrencies haven't been around as long as cyber attacks have been. The first cyber attack, I believe, happened in like the 1980s. Cryptocurrency didn't exist then. So to think that, you know, even if you take Bitcoin and cryptocurrency out of the equation, cybercrime will just stop is silly. Actual cyber criminals or whatever, or hacking collectives that do this type of stuff will continue to find a way to do what they have been doing long before cryptocurrency was a thing. And the other thing, of course, if you look at the Colonial Pipeline incident, the FBI was able to recover, again, partnership against cybercrime with the WEF and all of this stuff. They were able to recover most of the Bitcoin and paid in ransom without having Bitcoin heavily regulated, without having special new laws passed and new global alliances forged. Like, you know, all these people are calling to happen. Ransomware, I would argue this attention given to these ransomware events and the narratives being used for them is just a way to sort of advance talking points that ultimately benefit central bank-backed or Wall Street-backed digital currencies at the end of the day. Obviously, given all these agendas we've been talking about, the commonality there is this desire to end anonymity online, not just for, you know, people's use of the internet in terms of what websites are visited and what videos are watched, et cetera, but also financial transactions. And that's part of why there is this move to central bank digital currencies, is to end the ability for people to have anonymous financial transactions, because, you know, it's part of this broader move to having a massive surveillance state on the scale of which we've never seen before. And so obviously being able to not just surveil, but also control people's finances is very attractive there. If you look at the digital yuan in China, they're piloting, for example, you know, they're putting expiration dates on that. So you can't even decide if you hold digital yuan, if you can save or spend. Essentially, the central bank tells you when you have to spend your money by. And that's obviously a way to control people's finances quite directly. And it's no coincidence that since China has begun piloting the digital yuan and that project has advanced more than other CBDCs, we've seen China implement unprecedented crackdowns on the crypto space, including on Bitcoin mining. I think most recently, TikTok was forced to ban users on its video sharing platform from promoting crypto or marketing crypto-related services in any way. And several other Chinese companies have been forced to abide by that as well. You know, you can't even market or run ads for crypto-related entities in China anymore, essentially. And that's no coincidence that that happened right after the introduction of the digital yuan in this space. So I think, you know, as Fedcoin, as the Federal Reserves has been nicknamed, or the Britcoin, the Bank of England's central bank digital currency project, as these things advance, we're going to see those governments crack down on the space. And the justification they've essentially been handed is ransomware. But if you actually go back and you look at these supply chain attacks, I really want to stress the attribution of these hacks is very shady. They're almost always done by either cybersecurity firms linked directly to intelligence agencies, usually the U.S. or Israel, or they're done by, you know, groups like the CIA and the Director of National Intelligence, but they don't release any evidence publicly. They just say, take our word for it. And if you actually will read the analyses they do release, whether it's these cybersecurity companies or intelligence agencies, they don't even say, these guys definitely did it, Russia definitely did it. They say, it's probable, it's likely, and they don't release public evidence. And, you know, just looking at the SolarWinds hack, for example, that's probably, you know, the supply chain hack that really kicked this all off. FireEye, which even Bloomberg admits was essentially set up by the CIA, are the people that attributed the blame to Russia. And then the intelligence agency said, oh, it was likely Russian in origin. And then the media has just run with that uncritically ever since. And the FireEye CEO was recently had to testify to Congress about how he attributed that. And his reason is just a bunch of bullshit. I mean, it's basically on the same scale as like Russiagate, CrowdStrike type stuff. You know, saying he essentially said, well, this was a very disciplined hack, and only Russia is capable of performing disciplined hacks, which, you know, if you actually look at these signals intelligence cyber agencies around the world, the NSA, Israel's U-8200, or UK's GCHQ, I mean, obviously to say Russia's the only government with that capability is just reflects total ignorance. And it's amazing that Congress would just swallow such a that's not evidence, that's an opinion, you know, and to attribute that to a nation state based on that opinion alone is just ridiculous and shows that we're being taken for a ride here, I would argue. And then you also have the fact that the other piece of evidence from FireEye CEO is that, oh, I got a postcard in the mail. And I think it was from Russian intelligence, but he provides no evidence of that. Okay, so, you know, if that's the kind of detective work that these people are doing on these high levels, I mean, come on, we're obviously being lied to here. And, you know, the U.S. intelligence agencies and U.S. government, remember, the Department of Justice and the FBI are working with the World Economic Forum Center for Cybersecurity very closely. And the WEF just co-hosted Cyber Polygon with Russia's government in a state-controlled Russian bank. And there's no complaint there, but we're being told Russian hackers and Russian ransomware hackers that Putin's protecting are the reason that we have to regulate Bitcoin and we have to get a driver's license for the internet and all of this stuff. You know, it's obvious crap. And if you actually look into the SolarWinds hack and what probably happened there, like I did for T-Lab earlier this year, it essentially goes back to Israeli intelligence. Which is unsurprising when you look at, you know, their history in electronic espionage from the Promise software scandal, Amdocs, Converse, Infosys, in 2001, and then going up to, you know, some of these front companies that have emerged. And that's an embedded policy, by the way, using some of these Unit 8200 founded tech companies as fronts for intelligence. It's an admitted policy since 2012 of Israeli intelligence. I mean, these guys don't mess around. As an example, you know, I did a whole series on Cyber Reason, this Israeli intelligence leak cybersecurity company last year. The founder of that, a Unit 8200 guy, admits that his work at Cyber Reason is a continuation of his time in Israeli intelligence. He openly admits it. That's nuts. And what he did, that guy did at Unit 8200 was lead Unit 8200's offensive hacking efforts targeting nation states. That's insane. And the fact that these guys, Cyber Reason, works directly with the Pentagon and some of the biggest IT providers of the U.S. government, and that's never been a blip on anyone's cybersecurity radar, that's crazy. So there's obviously a lot more going on here than we've been told.
Yeah, and that leads into, in a good way, the next topic we're going to get into in a moment. We'll talk more about Israel and Unit 8200. Just a couple of things that come to mind. I'm going to just share my screen for a brief moment. I don't know if you ever actually saw this. I just happened to catch this. This is a tweet from the St. Louis Fed, I think it was. And let me see if it'll pop up. It says, you've likely heard of Bitcoin and maybe even Dogecoin, but what about Fedcoin? So even the... Even the Federal Reserve themselves is now calling themselves their project Fedcoin. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, it's just funny to me, like, because that's sort of been like the joke name that many of us have used, like, oh yeah, don't buy their coin, it's going to be Fedcoin. And now they're straight up calling it that.
I guess they're trying to co-opt the terminology for themselves. I don't really know any other way to look at it than that. But yeah, it's pretty telling. I mean,
so this is the head of the St. Louis Fed basically just acknowledging that, yeah, they're going to create a coin, or at least, you know, he's already promoting the idea and kind of endorsing the name Fedcoin, and says in one version of the CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, that some proponents are putting forth, CBDC would be provided free of charge for, say, for all U.S. persons, and this version of CBDC would obviously certainly not discourage less well-off people from accessing the banking sector. So, of course, it's just about helping poor people get into the banking system and just being kind to them. So I just wanted to point that out, that this is already, you know, people who are hearing about this, this is already in motion. They're talking about it openly now. It's not just chatter on the internet. Mm-hmm. And another point you brought up, as far as the hacks go, I mean, anybody who knows anything, even like sort of beginner level about crypto and Bitcoin, would know that the whole Colonial Pipeline thing just stinks like so much, because they're like, oh yeah, we were able to track the hackers. It is true that, I will say, I was reporting at Ross Ulbricht's trial, the Silk Road trial, back in 2013. And even back then, they were showing that they were able to track Ross using, you know, they had to use some different methods. It's not like they can do it as easy, but now they have chain analysis companies that literally just exist to study blockchains and report to companies or the governments. So it is possible for them to track you if you're using Bitcoin. But the other thing is, the way that they said they track these hackers at the Colonial Pipeline is that these guys, women, whoever made up people, were using like a Coinbase wallet, or they sent it to some like some public custodial wallet that is just...
It was sitting in some server in California that they could just nix it from. Yeah. And obviously, if these were like sophisticated, intelligent hackers, what would have happened?
Yeah, that would not be protocol. So it's just important to recognize, because you brought up a few other details kind of about these different hacks. And like, when you read the reports and see what the evidence they're putting forward, the problem is that they know that the average person, beyond, you know, kind of nerds for this stuff like you, myself, and maybe a few others, don't really bother reading those reports. And they just hear like the news says, oh yeah, look, the CIA confirmed it. And they're just like, yeah, this is...
Let's trust the CIA. They've never lied before.
Yeah. And so there's just this, there's not like deep thinking on it. And I just wanted to make that point. Mm-hmm. And then you started to get into Israel. So let's talk about that, because in the same article that we've been referencing here, the Ending Anonymity, the WEF's partnership against cybercrime, you also get into the Talpiot connection, which is something that I've been getting more aware of in the last few years. Obviously, anybody who spends time in these spaces, I think, will recognize that Israel plays an outsized role, kind of like you mentioned, like we're being told to be afraid of the Russians while there's a Russian state bank, you know, helping us with cyber terror exercises. But really, I think the big concern, if there's going to be one nation state to look at, it would probably have to be Israel. I mean, the Israelis are, you know, we could go all day about just ties to 9/11 and other things. But talk a little bit about this Talpiot program. I know that you didn't go super in depth, but there's some important information in here for those who might not be aware.
Okay, so the reason I bring that up in my article is because basically the driver of the strategy for all things cyber for the World Economic Forum, their top like cyber strategist, the guy that runs that for them, is this guy named Tal Goldstein. And actually, if you look on his bio on the World Economic Forum, it says he's head of strategy for the WEF entirely. But he's definitely head of it for the cyber strategy stuff, and looking into his background is really significant. So the first thing he says in his bio, admittedly, is that he's a Talpiot graduate. So what is the Talpiot program? Sometimes it's described as the IDF's like Mensa. They you know, go to kids in Israel in high school that have high leadership aptitude and high demonstrated ability in sciences and technological related stuff. And it's essentially a feeder program for kids like that into the upper echelons of the Israeli intelligence community, where the real decisions are made and the real big stuff happens, right? This program was actually developed by an Israeli, notorious Israeli spy master, Rafi Eitan, that people in the United States should know, because he was the mastermind not only of the Promise Software scandal, which, if you read my series on the Epstein scandal and Robert Maxwell and all of that stuff, is very significant. Essentially, Israel installed a backdoor into software that was then sold to classified U.S. institutions, specifically involved in the nuclear program, but also to governments and private companies all over the world, including Russia and all over the place, the main salesperson for that being Robert Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's father. Rafi Eitan was also Jonathan Pollard's handler, Jonathan Pollard being widely considered to be the most damaging spy in U.S. history. And of course, he was a spy for the state of Israel. So Rafi Eitan is the guy that developed this program. And it still exists today. So essentially, when you see someone touting their Talpiot credentials, they essentially are saying that they're from this upper echelon community where the real decisions are made in Israeli intelligence. And these Talpiot graduates, more often than not, then tend to be placed in high-ranking positions after they formally, after they're no longer formally part of the intelligence or military intelligence apparatus. They go into the high-tech world, the cybersecurity world, the software world, which is a major sector of Israel's economy. And if you've read my reporting on it, which I've done extensive work on, Israelis high-tech startup, tech startup sector, their software sector, specifically cybersecurity, intimately connected to military intelligence and Unit 8200. Even in Israel, the government admits that it's hard to know where the private sector begins and the public ends. What better WEF model in action than that? And, you know, it's also China does this to a degree as well. In China, they call it the civil military fusion concept. People like Eric Schmidt in the U.S., the former Google CEO, who has a lot of influence on national security technology policy, wants to implement that directly in the U.S. He's a big funder of Israeli intelligence fronts, including Team 8, which is led by the former commander of Unit 8200. Of course, Team 8 is another big part of the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime and the WEF Center for Cybersecurity. Their commander, the former commander of Unit 8200 that runs Team 8, has contributed to several WEF policy papers. He did a panel on the Great Reset next to Netanyahu. You know, even though Israel it claims to be anti-globalist and like anti-UN, they're intimately involved in these efforts. I would argue it's because they have been promised a big, if not the biggest, share of the cyber pie, I guess you could say, if and when they manage to get this giant global panopticon established. And that's been an openly stated goal of Netanyahu's for some time. I mean, if you listen to his talk at like these cyber tech conferences in Israel, he's pretty open about that. And his main strategist for that strategy of dominance is Tal Goldstein, the same guy that the WEF now has as their head of strategy. And that particular strategy is the one I mentioned earlier, the admitted policy in 2012, where in 2019, Israel's government admitted this, and it came out in Israeli media, that the decision was made back in 2012. And Tal Goldstein was one of the main people involved in this, along with Netanyahu, who was prime minister, of course, at the time. The decision was made that operations previously conducted in-house by Mossad, Unit 8200, et cetera, would now be sort of offshored to private companies, some of those private companies being expressly created for that purpose, i.e. expressly created to serve as intelligence fronts for Israel. And the one that they admit to in there is Black Cube. That Black Cube was literally set up with the intention of being a privatized Mossad. And that's why, you know, their involvement in things like the Harvey Weinstein scandal, among other things, is so significant, because it's literally privatized Mossad. And people in Israel's community, like Ehud Barak and stuff, when they recommended that to Harvey Weinstein, knew that to be the case, right? So anyway, the whole purpose of that is not just to have these intelligence fronts conduct intelligence operations, but also to have those companies acquired by larger multinational tech companies, specifically those in Silicon Valley, and with a target on specifically Silicon Valley because it's based in the U.S., and that being seen as a way to prevent the U.S. from ever meaningfully adopting boycott, divest, and sanctions, or the BDS movement in the U.S. And this is an admitted policy. And Paul Singer, the neocon billionaire that funds people like Marco Rubio and a lot of the neocons and stuff, created this thing called Startup Nation Central at the same time in direct coordination with top people at AIPAC and in Netanyahu's office to further that same agenda and speed up the acquisition of these companies by Silicon Valley entities. So this is really significant that we see Tal Goldstein as the head of strategy of the World Economic Forum right now in the context of Cyber Polygon, because this is a guy who has basically developed and implemented a policy of using private companies as fronts for intelligence. And a lot of these same private companies now, you know, attributing blame and stuff for these hacks, including CrowdStrike and stuff, are part of these partnership against cybercrime stuff that this guy is essentially leading. So we can't trust these people, obviously, at the end of the day, because as I mentioned earlier, the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime is all about developing a shared narrative to advance long-term strategic interests of the stakeholders, i.e. the public sector and the private sector partners that make up the Partnership Against Cybercrime. So this is a guy that has used these entities as fronts for intelligence operations in the past. Why else would the WEF have hired this guy if that's his background to be their top cyber strategist? I mean, obviously, to me anyway, that's a big red flag that something is definitely amiss with the situation here.
Yeah, and I definitely want to recommend everybody do go back. I'll include the links to check out your Cyber Reason articles on that. Was some great reporting there. And, you know, you mentioned, we've talked about it a couple times now, the Promise scandal, software scandal, which is, again, just like with Oklahoma City, it's so crazy that these operations that were happening before some of us were born, you know, are still like relevant and still taking place. Like, and I also want to shout out journalist Danny Casolaro, who, you know, was basically suicided and and pursuing that story. For anybody who doesn't know that, go check out a book called The Last Circle, or just look up Danny Casolaro and the Promise scandal. He was one of the people trying to reveal that and reveal the nature of the surveillance apparatus way back in the early 90s. And he was found, supposedly killed himself. And
yeah, that was actually in 1991. And not only did Casolaro die that year, but three other people tied to the Promise software scandal died, including Robert Maxwell, the main salesperson. And then also his Casolaro, one of his main sources from within the government, Alan Standorf, was found mysteriously dead as well in a field. And then Senator John Tower, who is the person that got Robert Maxwell access to the classified U.S. institutions he sold Promise to, also died in a suspicious plane crash the same year. So it was definitely a major year for government fuckery, I guess you could say. And it's no coincidence around that same time, that same year also is when Attorney General Bill Barr, when he was Attorney General the first time, pardons all the Iran-Contra criminals, many of whom were also involved in the scandal. And then also proceeds to oversee the cover up of the Promise software scandal itself.
Exactly. There's so much that took place in the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s that is still relevant and still affecting those of us who are around today. So I just wanted to make that point before we move on to the next part of our discussion. So, hey, Whitney, I think we can maybe, as just in the interest of time, I'm going to cut one of my questions and we'll just focus on the Welcome Leap, the first 1,000 days program. I'll just move to that so we can wrap up in like 15, 20 minutes. Does that work?
Okay. Yeah. That works fine. I just need to make sure I'm not, I'm supposed to get a call from the doctor's office, but I can call them back as long as it's before 5. So that's all right.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I'll make sure we're done by then. I just wanted to make that note. All right. We'll pick up right there. Okay, so let's switch gears now and talk a little bit about your most recent report, which is titled A Leap Towards Humanity's Destruction. And I'm glad you did this because, you know, over the last year and a half since COVID began, as you, myself, James, and others have been looking at the various pieces of the puzzle, I remember looking at all the Gates connected, World Economic Forum connected organizations and foundations, and there's a lot of them. They have their tentacles everywhere. And Wellcome Trust was definitely part of that kind of apparatus and that infrastructure. And you've done a great job now kind of going into what their latest efforts are. And some of that gets into talk about wearables. And I think it's interesting that you're covering this. I know that you and James just had a conversation about this that was placed on YouTube and of course deleted pretty quickly.
Within two hours.
And that doesn't surprise me because honestly, when my YouTube channel was, you know, I'm no longer on YouTube. I haven't bothered to try to go back. But when my YouTube channel was deleted last October, the last video that I put up was about Google's connections to Galvani, bioelectronics, and to wearable technology. And it was titled something like, wearables are the future of health, you know, technology, something like that. And that basically got my channel deleted. And that was based on an article I wrote for Last American Vagabond. But so let's talk a little bit about that, about how wearables are, you know, let's talk about the wearables first, and then we'll talk about the first 1,000 days program.
Okay, so Welcome Leap and a couple other initiatives going on right now on companies like Galvani, which are basically Silicon Valley and Big Pharma coming together, are a clear indication that basically COVID wasn't just a catalyst for the Great Reset and in other spheres, but specifically in for a Great Reset, you could argue, in healthcare to basically redefine medicine and healthcare and medical care as being based around wearables, gene editing therapies, what they call precision medicine, which involves both of those. And this is something that was heavily within the U.S. funded and pursued by the Obama administration, specifically with the involvement of then Vice President Biden. It's no coincidence that Biden now has advanced that agenda even more and is trying to get funded basically what would be health DARPA or HARPA, which was originally pitched to Trump, but is now being pursued by Biden for under a different justification. But it's the same. It's the same thing. And basically, what HARPA, according to the Biden administration, wants to pursue is the same stuff: precision medicine, mRNA vaccines tailored to your genome to treat and prevent cancer, with an emphasis on prevention and things like that. But of course, you know, what's not being said is that a lot of these gene editing therapies, specifically CRISPR, more is coming out every year that these have major consequences, cause DNA damage. And we don't fully understand how this stuff even works anyway, but they're pushing full steam ahead with it. And in addition to that, of course, is this proliferation of nanotechnology as medicine, and also wearables as a way to know what's going in your body, going on in your body before there's symptoms of a disease, and all of this stuff. They've been promoted over the past year and a half by the private sector, big pharma, and also the U.S. military as a way to know if you have COVID before you have symptoms. But they've since extended that to it. We can detect any disease before you have symptoms, as long as you wear a wearable. And of course, wearables have major implications for surveillance. We've seen this already with existing wearables sold to us as fitness promoting wearables, like Fitbit or Amazon's Halo, which also claims that it can surveil and determine your emotional state in addition to your physical state. And it's an obvious data grab for Silicon Valley companies in that regard. And Google, of course, is intimately involved in that and doesn't like to talk about this. There's a lot of different ways to look at Google's involvement. Galvani Bioelectronics, which I know you've reported on extensively, is, you know, basically a nanoelectronic medicine company. That's the combination of GlaxoSmithKline and a Google subsidiary. So, you know, they're obviously intimately involved in that same Google subsidiary there. Verily has been doing a lot of the COVID-19 testing in the U.S. over the past year and a half, and has been linking people's genetic data to their Gmail account or their Google account, because people that take COVID-19 tests run by Verily have to provide their Google login information as well. And this is at the same time that Google has also partnered with the Pentagon to develop AI algorithms to predict cancer before symptoms even appear, or a tumor appears, or anything like that. And of course, it's worth pointing out that no AI algorithm on the market today or even in research has 100% accuracy. So I just want to stress that a lot of this stuff is not as accurate necessarily as they make it claim. And of course, even the reports on their accuracy often come from the company that produces the algorithm itself. And so they are in a conflict of interest and obviously overselling the efficacy of these algorithms. So, you know, that's an important point that gets left out of the discussion sometimes. And Google's also invested in the AstraZeneca Oxford vaccine for COVID-19 and other things, and they don't like this stuff coming out. And of course, a Google co-founder, his Sergey Brin, his wife, Anne Wojcicki, the sister of YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki, is the head of 23andMe, one of the main gene sequencing companies that is going to be intimately tied to this precision medicine effort as it advances. So I would argue that's why Google is so intent on censoring a lot of discussion there. I think another reason too is just by looking at Wellcome Leap, because Wellcome Leap is the merging of the Wellcome Trust, which is sort of the easiest way to describe it. People don't know what it is. It's sort of like, in terms of influence, like the Gates Foundation, but based in the UK, and it's much older and has more prestige, I guess you could say, but has a very similar agenda in terms of the type of things it funds in terms of medical research and things like that. So it's a combination of the Wellcome Trust with basically these two individuals that used to be the leadership at DARPA, the Pentagon's DARPA, and then later were recruited to create DARPA equivalents at Google and then at Facebook, right? So these two top former Google executives now involved with Welcome Leap directly. So, you know, a lot of Google involvement in different facets of this agenda. And that's obviously something they don't want aired out at the moment, their conflicts of interest that they have in all these different initiatives. So if you want, I can get more into the different programs about Welcome Leap, unless there's something more you'd like me to add on those points.
No, you can go ahead. Let's get into the First 1,000 Days program. And I know that you said there was another one you wanted to mention as well.
Yeah, so there's actually four programs at Welcome Leap, but two that I think are particularly important. The first is called The First 1,000 Days, and it focuses on kids, specifically babies from 3 months to 3 years. And the other one is called Multi-Channel Psych and is focused mainly on adults. Sorry about that. So the first 1,000 Days, I think is really significant. For nothing else, and the fact that they want to use literal babies from 3 months up to toddlers of 3 years as their main test subjects, which I think is just completely abhorrent. And of course, this can only advance if parents are totally asleep at the freaking wheel and allow their children to be submitted to this crap. Basically, what it is they want infants' brains to be mapped from 3 months of age up to 3 years with a couple different goals. So the first goal is to basically use the mapping of thousands and later millions of babies in order to develop an AI model, what they call an in silico model of a developing human brain, in the hopes that it will continue to develop as the human brain does, leading thus to the singularity. They don't say that, but if you read between the lines, it's what they want to pursue. And if you are familiar with the field of AI at all, there's almost this godlike worship of the singularity when it comes. And a lot of the AI control systems that the elite want to implement are dependent on the singularity eventually emerging, and it hasn't emerged yet. So essentially what they want to do is within 10 years from now, it's not that long, I have this done to like 80% of the world's children. And that's pretty significant. And, you know, if you're looking at people tied to Google, tied to the US military, and tied to the Wellcome Trust, the world's richest and most influential medical research charity, you know, these aren't small time players. And I think they definitely feel emboldened by what's gone on with COVID-19. A lot of parents have willingly put up their toddlers and even babies to be test subjects in COVID-19 trials for children that are so young that their risk of dying or having even symptoms of COVID-19 is so negligible and so low. I mean, it's just obviously emboldened these psychopaths. So anyway, beyond that, after they have this in silico model, this synthetic artificial neural network of what they think is the perfect human brain or perfect child's brain, then they want to go and again, with 80% of kids within 10 years, tweak and prune those kids' brains so that they match the AI model. And this is totally insane. This is a recipe for creating generations upon generations of drone humans. It has the potential to eliminate creativity and imagination in, you know, the youngest humans, and has major implications for humanity as a species there. On the other side of it, the technology they want to use on these kids are wearables, 24/7 surveillance, eye tracking technology, and, you know, different things that measure their you know, neural activity. And in a sense, that's acclimating children from babies on to having this type of stuff on them and around them and being constantly surveilled at all times to normalize that behavior in children. So this is frankly sick. It's probably, I think it's proof that these people feel really emboldened and they can't be stopped. But I think it's also proof that these people are very behind in their artificial intelligence goals, which is, of course, to the advantage of people that want to resist this, because they need so many kids, they think anyway, to be able to develop the singularity and develop this type of power. And they can only obtain that if people are willing to relinquish their rights over their children and entrap them in this type of reality in the future. And so I think The fact they're just starting this is also an indicator that it can be stopped. But it, you know, people have to start drawing a red line. This is the thing to draw a red line on with kids this young and stuff. I mean, it's totally insane. They can't consent. Don't do this to your kid. It's total madness. I have been saying in several interviews about this that if you go to the Welcome Leap website, there's a list of the researchers for this at universities around the world, and the project leader who lives in the UK, email these people and tell them what you think about what they're doing. These academics and stuff are used to being in their isolated little academic ivory towers and not push back from the public. This program is totally sick. And that needs to change. You know, people need to draw a red line there. So I would encourage people to do that. So the next program is sort of like this for adults.
Well, let me just add real quick, sure. Jack. Mm-hmm. I just want to say that before you continue to the one that's about adults, which is equally, I think, disturbing, but you're right. And I've heard you mention this in a couple of interviews and in the article that I really think people should make sure to take in how disturbing this program is focused on the kids. Like, and I think you're right. You know, I know that you're a parent, and I know there's lots of folks who are parents in the audience, and I have young nieces and nephews, and just this idea that this is the world that they're trying to craft and create for the future, which, you know, it's just disturbing. This is the transhumanist technocratic agenda really coming out into play, and they're putting it all
and into the open.
Yeah, this they're is putting it all out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so go ahead.
Yeah, I definitely agree. This is as blatant as it could be. And, you know, I think, like I said earlier, this is because they feel so emboldened because of how many people have rolled over for COVID-19. Will we roll over as much for the transhumanism tech and the essentially a potential elimination of creativity and imagination and the manipulation of children's brains worldwide by these people? I certainly hope not. But, you know, of course, it depends on people's willingness to resist this agenda, and also in how they try and implement this worldwide. But we should nip it in the bud now. That's what I would argue. And more attention needs to be given to the Wellcome Trust, I think, which is essentially funding and driving this research. And they haven't been getting as much attention as they deserve. Anyway, on to the next program. That's like this anyway. Like I said, there's four, but we're just focusing on two today. The other one is called multi-channel psych. And it's basically, they claim it's about treating depression. But if you read between the lines there, they say it's not about treating depression in a way that allows depressed people to experience pleasure again or feel better about their life or improve their quality of life. It's about treating aspects of depression that prevent depressed people from being good worker bees and accomplishing tasks at work. And it basically talks about developing a wearable that can measure all these different things about you, including your emotional state, which Amazon's already does, as I mentioned, but also your effort and motivation levels and things like that. And that, once developed, will obviously be abused by corporate America. I mean, Amazon is already making their warehouse workers wear like wristbands and stuff that like buzz them and tell them what to do. It's only a matter of time until these predatory corporations try and mandate that. And they're like, well, you're not putting enough effort in according to the wearable you're wearing and the algorithm that analyzes the data it consumes or it extracts. You know, I mean, that's obviously like opening a door to an extreme corporate dystopia, but it also wants to develop technology to, if the wearable detects something maybe amiss with you, separate technology you can then be subjected to that directly interrogates the human brain state, as they say in there, basically something that can read your mind, determine if you are engaging in wrong think or if you need to have intervention into the neural networks in your brain, not unlike what they're trying to do with kids in this previous program, but for adults, essentially, to make sure that people stay good worker slaves for all intents and purposes. And this, again, is, you know, just focused on wearables and developing wearables that provide them these types of insights. I would argue it's that provide them complete surveillance and control over a person and thus over society. And it's important to point out that this wearable agenda is advancing really quickly. Jeremy Lafredo did a piece for Unlimited Hangout recently about how, and I also mentioned this in my article on HARPA, how health insurance companies in the US and also life insurance companies are offering discounts and stuff if you use a wearable all the time. It's only a matter of time until they offer people free healthcare if you wear a wearable constantly. And, you know, people that advocate for Medicare for All and want to see that implemented should be very wary of this, because it will just provide Silicon Valley with complete control over people's lives, including companies like Amazon that a lot of people like Medicare for All don't like and think is a monopoly, rightly so. You know, I think it's a really dangerous agenda in that sense, but they're going to offer it for free, but it won't really be free, because you'll be giving up your complete privacy, including privacy over what's going on within your body. And if they get this developed like they want with Vulcan Leap, even what's going on in your brain and stuff, you'll be giving that up, and also constantly giving up your biometric data to feed the AI beast in the Silicon Valley machine, which, by the way, Silicon Valley intimately connected with the military and the intelligence community in the U.S. at this point. It's really hard to tell where Silicon Valley ends and the national security state begins, right? So is it really free in that case? No, it's not. But that's what they're going to try and get people to adopt it. And, you know, they'll be like, oh, we'll give you free healthcare, but it's going to be this precision medicine based around wearables and nanotechnology and all of this stuff. That's the free, quote unquote, free healthcare they're going to be giving and offering to people. And, you know, it's a total trap. And I hope people are aware of it, but they need mass adoption of that. So in my view, the way for them to get mass adoption is to offer it, quote unquote, for free. And we've already seen over COVID-19, over the course of this crisis, Singapore, which their ambition is to be the world's first smart nation, right? Over the course of the past year and a half, they've given a wearable to every one of their citizens and mandated it for use in lieu of a vaccine passport. You have to have, or that's their contact tracing program, is that everyone has to have a wearable. That's insane. So, but it was provided for free, right? They were like, here's your free wearable. You have to use it all the time. And they link it to services, not unlike they plan to do with vaccine passports and stuff. And that's probably the model that they'll try to be following in other countries. We have to be really wary of this, because if you look at people like that are responsible, you know, philosophers for the World Economic Forum, like this guy, Yuval Noah Harari, this Israeli historian, he gave this talk I encourage everyone to watch from the Davos, the World Economic Forum annual meeting in 2020, right before COVID kicked off. And he was essentially like, the second there is mass adoption of wearables that can monitor what's going what you're doing both externally and internally, then the world crosses a line into the era of digital dictatorships. And that's an irreversible step into that future. And then he openly, you know, calls on the WEF to create this world, because if the WEF doesn't do it, then the rats might get hold of this technology and use it for other purposes. And if you watch the speech, which I please do watch it, it's very clear that the rats are the underclass, not the elite, right? So, you know, that's pretty jarring when you consider it. And so they're actively trying to usher in this age of digital dictatorship. And, you know, they're going to offer it to us with all this stuff. Oh, you'll get free healthcare and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's a Trojan horse for something really awful that once implemented will be difficult, if not impossible, to reverse.
Absolutely. Wow. Such a powerful bit of information there, Whitney. And you're right that it's, you know, we need to be wary of governments offering free things. And especially when it comes to the digital side of things, it is a digital dictatorship that they are in the process of implementing. I think a lot of people are recognizing it. Part of that is to demonize anybody that has opposing views, domestic extremists, you know, yeah, cyber terrorists, and use that to implement a digital ID for the internet to try to demonize anonymous and decentralized cryptocurrencies and alternative currencies that would allow people outside the banking system, while remaking the system and pushing all these wearable techs and implantables, injectables, these types of things. I mean, this is the future, guys, that we are, and not the far off future, the next 5 to 10 years future, yeah, next couple of years that we are faced with right now. And I appreciate you saying to draw a line in the sand. And just as we wrap up here, I wanted to mention that, you know, this is a transhumanist technocratic agenda. And I think people are recognizing technocratic in the sense that it's a rule by experts, by elites, by, you know, these technologists, and transhumanist in the sense that they are trying to change what it means to be a human being. Absolutely. And move us beyond that and erase that, like you said, erase creativity, erase imagination. So we need to take that in. And I recently heard you mention that, you know, you support the idea of counter economics, and this is, my audience will be familiar with the concept, that something that I've pushed for a long time. For those who are new to the concept, I can recommend going to my website and just searching counter-economics. But essentially, what it comes down to, the most simple way that I explain it to people, is to opt out of the systems that don't align with your values. You know, that's why some of us use Monero instead of the dollar or Bitcoin like that. Or we try to say, hey, I'm going to grow as much of my own food instead of relying on the grocery stores, or I'm going to work with farmers markets or community supported agriculture, whatever it may be. It's trying to opt out of those systems and create this counter economy, counter institutions, because I really see that that is the only way forward. The governments are corrupt. The corporations are clearly working together, public-private partnerships. The courts are corrupt. You know, I don't see another way out that involves working within the system. So just as we close out, any thoughts or, you know, what that means to you to support or want to encourage counter-economics?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. So if you look at, like, you know, this whole effort to move society into this transhumanist digital dictatorship thing, the code word for this that the World Economic Forum and other people use is like the fourth industrial revolution, right? And the people driving this are governments, including the U.S. government, and also major companies, including Amazon, that a lot of people rely on, mainly Silicon Valley companies, but a lot of other big companies that a lot of us depend on, you know, a lot of brands in the supermarket and stuff like this are on board with this agenda. So in order to deprive them of their power over us, we have to stop being dependent on them. And the way to do that is to operate economically outside of them and not need them to meet your basic, you know, essential needs. So you can, you know, get on with life without them. And that's really the key way, I think, to deprive them of their power and influence, is for people to just stop using their stuff. I think a key way to advance that is to decouple yourself from big tech, at least the biggest names, as much as you possibly can. And, you know, if you rely on your smartphone heavily, try and use it less. Don't wear a wearable. Say no to wearables, period, I would argue, given what that agenda means and the type of data they can collect off of you. There's a line that should be drawn. That line is different for everyone, but people need to start saying what line they won't cross. And then when it comes up, not to cross it. You can only sell your liberty for convenience for so long until you give up all your liberties entirely. And people need to realize what the agenda is and realize where they stand and how far they will go. And then when it gets to that point, say, I'm not going any farther. I'm going to opt out and I'm going to move on. And obviously the key way to opt out is to have some sort of counter economic system set up to develop a local resilient communities. As I learned, unfortunately, you know, living at the end of the world in Chile, you know, I thought when the next crisis came, I would sort of be immune where I was living in this rural area. I learned otherwise with the COVID crisis, and now I'm in the UK, and, you know, it's pretty clear, like, no matter where you go in the world, this is an agenda you're not going to escape. The only way out is to develop resilient and resistant communities that can weather the storm and resist this agenda. And, you know, that's localism and that's counter economics at the end of the day.
Beautiful. Yeah. Thank you again for, you know, I think recognizing that, and, you know, in line with what you said, that there's a line in the sand. It's going to be different for everybody. People need to just take some time to really think about that. I mean, I think it's as simple and just basic as sit down and write down your thoughts. Like, look, if this happens, this is like the line in the sand for me. Like this, you know, I came to Mexico because for me, a line in the sand was them being the United States government and their partners starting to talk about restricting travel to, you know, interstate travel. And that's what they started to talk about at the beginning of the COVID thing. And back in March, they were already, you know, they were checking people's license plates, leaving New York. And so anyways, my point is that was a line for me that I felt like, okay, I need to make some moves. I need to go somewhere. I feel like I can get some land and, you know, make these changes, whatever that looks like for you. You're right that it needs to be local. It needs to be decentralized. And I think that's really the only way forward. So I just want to encourage everybody to look further into that concept. And even if you don't want to read about it, just do it. Just start decoupling yourself from the system. And thank you so much, Whitney, for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. One thing I do want to add, though, is that I know some people don't want to use crypto for whatever reason as a way of like counter economics. And if you're one of those people, I would encourage you to look at the work of Catherine Austin Fitz at Solari, the Solari Report. She essentially says the best way, they talk a lot about how to use, you know, make up a counter economic system, just using currency, just pull out your coins that you use and the, you know, and just start using it, but in your local community, independent of the Fed, or use gold and silver coins, whatever you decide on as a community, just start using it is the best way to implement this stuff if you don't want to use crypto. So there's a lot, there's a lot of options out there for people that don't want to go the digital route. And all it really takes is just sitting down with like-minded people in your community and having these discussions, making these plans, and starting to do something about it. Because as I point out in my most recent article for TLAV on the WEF Partnership Against Cybercrime, their efforts to clamp down on the effort, on the online world is just a confirmation that online activism, whatever that looks like for you, has to coincide with real world action you are taking. We can't just be doing all of our activism online. We have to take action in the real world, and the sooner the better.
Yeah, such an important point, because so many people have become, you know, kind of grown up on the internet and their activism is exclusively digital or online. And you're right, it doesn't, your counter economic activity can, I've visited communities where they created their own local paper currency. You can, like you said, you can use BART, you know, anything that gets you outside the system is the point. So thank you for that note. Everybody, you can find Whitney's work at unlimitedhangout.com and Last American Vagabond. All the articles that we covered today will be listed in the show notes. And I hope you will take this conversation seriously, not just consume it as infotainment, conspiratainment, but really come away from this with some thoughts on what you can do for your family to be prepared, because that's what really matters more than anything. All right, guys, until next time, remember, you are powerful, you are beautiful, and you are free. Peace.